All right, the House Ways and Means Committee is going to come to order. It's March 6, 2006. I'm present, and today we're going to do an overview of the permanent fund. President is Representative Wilson joining me. Permanent fund investment confidentiality or overview. We have before us today Mike Burns, the Executive Director of the Alaska Permanent Fund Division Corporation. Good morning, Mr. Burns.
Morning.
Is there anyone you wanted to join you at the witness table today?
Ms. O'Shea, I think.
Okay. Joining Mr. Burns is Laura O'Shea, and if one of you speaks, just identify yourself for the printed record. The reason we call this meeting to order is House Committee on our Special Committee on Ways and Means has introduced measures dealing with permanent fund, specifically the percent of market value, and moved that out of committee last year because we found it important. We've done some oversight of permanent fund operations in the context of sustaining revenues for the state of Alaska. It's not within our purview to be the oversight specifically of the permanent fund. As you know, there's other committees that responsible for doing that. But because there's so many people that are busy and so many committees that are busy, we wanted to be able to do an overview now and have an opportunity to question the permanent fund about any confidentiality procedures or policies that you have in place now that may guide your investment decisions. In addition, the reason we called this meeting is because recent issues that have been in the press related to confidentiality invoking confidentiality or restrictions on release of information by the permanent fund has raised questions, and we wanted to be able to have an open exchange of what those questions are and what confidentiality policies guide the permanent fund. And finally, there has been some things in the press and from the Permanent Fund Division Corporation that has indicated that there has been some interest by the administration for the Permanent Fund Corporation to invest in the gas pipeline. And we wanted to be able to ask questions about that because this is a very important fund to the people in the state of Alaska. And any questions about the permanent fund that may undermine its positions on anything, I think, is receives the highest scrutiny by the public, and right out of the chute, there's questions. And so we want to be able to have an exchange between the legislature through this committee and the corporation through you on what you're doing, what you're up to, what issues are, and what issues are guiding you, and fully allow you the opportunity to air this in public so that there's no question about what's going on. I hope we've made that clear in advance of this meeting that that was the intent of the meeting.
Absolutely.
Okay. And so also joining us is Representative Seaton. So prior to the meeting, we generally reviewed some of the regulatory and statutory issues or policy guidelines that the legislature has set forth that guide the corporation's investments. And you were going to hand out either the statutes or regulations to the committee? Okay, there. You've emailed those to the committee, and those are also available to the public. And also you've passed out information on the prudent investor rule and what guides that. And to some extent, there may be some confidentiality requirements that you have to invoke as a prudent investor. But I'm going to turn it over to you, Mr. Burns, to let you testify before the committee, and then we'll open up the committee to questions of you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And it's a pleasure to be here in front of you and to air these subjects because we think it's very important, as you have stated, the public has a full awareness of what we're doing and how we're doing it. Let me just start off with the basic statement, and I will probably refer to this several times, but there is nothing confidential today that was not confidential a year ago, 5 years ago, 25 years ago. In 1980, the Permanent Fund Corporation was created. Several statutes created the corporation and empowered it to manage the funds of the permanent fund. One of the statutes, 3713-200, if I might just read this, it's a short one, so it'll just take a second, but I think it's important. Information in the possession of the corporation is a public record, except that information that discloses the particulars of the business or affairs of a private enterprise or investor is confidential and is not a public record. Confidential information may be disclosed only for the purpose of an official law enforcement investigation or when its production is required in a court proceeding. These restrictions do not prohibit the publication of statistics presented in a manner that prevents the identification of particular reports, items, persons, or enterprises. So that has been on the books since 1980.
Mr. Burns? Yeah. Representative Seaton?
I'm just trying to get some clarification because we do get reports, I think, of the different managers and what their rates of return are.
Yes.
So that specifically isn't considered part of the business section. Is that my understanding?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, it depends on the managers. And basically what we're talking about, the issue that we have are the managers that manage non-public assets and specifically in the private equity area and in absolute return. And we have contractual relationships with them. What they have is basically is their intellectual property, is their strategies. And that is very important to them, that their strategies, the amount of money they commit to the strategies, who their personnel are, is not available to their competitors. It is a very, very competitive area. I would also tell you in both of these asset types, private equity and alternative investments, fall under an investment term called alternative investments. In probably 75% to 80% of the returns in this asset class come from the top third of the managers. So it's very important for us to be associated with the best people in this field. In every other asset class, I don't mean to sound arrogant, but the permanent fund is the kind of client people want desperately. We're large. I think we have a good reputation. So we have people in almost all asset classes really going out of their way to have us as their client or try to make us their client. In alternative investments, it's a seller's market. It's not a buyer's market. And so it's very important for us, as I said, to be with this top third of the managers. That's absolutely critical to us. And they're the ones that consider their information most confidential. That's what their success, their intellectual property is built upon. And so they, you know, we accommodate them under the statute that was passed in 1980. And maybe it was a long question or a long answer to your question.
Is there a follow-up?
Yes. Thank you. What I was trying to get to was, though, that the gross return or the net return or whatever that increase or decrease in that particular manager's monthly or whatever that is of our assets, that number, is that available
Absolutely.
To the public?
Yes. As a matter of fact, just if I could come through this just real quickly, I have a...
Just for the record, we're joined by Representative Roakberg. Representative Roakberg, for your information, we're in the packet. Resolution 0504 has been handed out, along with some other records handed out by the Permanent Fund. Mr. Burns has recited AS 3713-200 and now is just simply responding to preliminary questions. Go ahead, Mr. Burns.
Yes. Also, not only are those available, they are available online. That's all posted on our website. In absolute return, since we've been in this since July of 2004, the target in absolute return, and let me just back up just 1 second. Most of our returns are based against a benchmark. We'll hire someone, say, we want you to manage against the S&P 500 or the S&P 1000 or the Lehman aggregate or whatever, and their relative returns are based against that benchmark. In absolute return, we hire people to basically manage risk, and we don't want a big upside, we don't want a big downside. We want a narrow band of returns. The target for our absolute return is the one-month LIBOR rate, which LIBOR is an acronym for the London Interbank Offering Rate, which is an overnight trading of funds between major banks on a worldwide basis. So it's fairly close to a Treasury bill return or a Fed fund return. It's a very low cash rate. So our target is LIBOR plus 400 basis points or 4%. Inception to date, that LIBOR plus 4%, the target was 7.31%. We have earned 9.61%. And two other things I think that are important. The money that we have put into this strategy has come out of fixed income or our bond portfolio. Over that same time frame, the annualized return for the bond portfolio was 3.95%. So our target was 7.31. We earned 9.61, and it came out of bonds that were earning 3.95. I'm not going to try to bury you with statistics, but two more. The measure of risk, the way we measure risk in our portfolio, is by the standard deviation. The standard deviation for the bond portfolio that earned 3.95% was 2.83%. The standard deviation for our absolute return, which earned 9.61, was 2.67%. So we have exceeded our goal. We have more than doubled the fixed income return with less risk. Just as a sidelight to that, I think many of you have over the years have heard Mr. O'Leary from Callan Associates, who is our investment consultant, who comes in once a year and makes a presentation to the legislature on Callan's capital market outlook. And it's basically the historical returns. They take a five-year look and what could be expected. Then they take the capital market assumptions and put them into a program they call the Optimizer, which will give you various portfolio constructions at different percentages of different types of assets will come up with an ideal portfolio, and then the trustees make the determination as to which actual asset mix they want to have. In absolute return, they have to constrain how much will go into absolute return. With these returns and this low risk profile, this asset class would hog out everything else. And then you have diversification problems and challenges. So they absolutely have to restrain this asset class.
Mr. Burns, one of the things I was curious about on the resolution 0504 that was adopted in 2005 in November 2005, and if these policies have been in place for so long, why was this resolution just so recently adopted? Was it in reaction to something?
We started getting inquiries, which at a pace that we had not before on some of these assets. And in 2004, the board was advised by our counsel that under state law, the board was considered the head of an agency, and therefore would have the responsibilities for considering public records requests. That just was not practical for the board meeting six or seven or five times a year to respond as the statute requires. I believe it's a 10-day response. And when the board meeting irregularly, those did not work. So the resolution, I believe the one you have in front of you, empowered the executive director or me to respond to the records request. So that's why that was adopted. The follow-on, the adoption of the regulation, we thought that was a more straightforward way than to do this just by resolution. We thought to bring it to the public's attention, go through the regulation process, and make a regulation almost identical to the one that the State Pension Board has had on the books since 1996.
One of the issues is whether the state of Alaska has been attempting to pressure the corporation to invest permanent fund dividend payments in the gas pipeline. And I was curious if under the public access to information statute you had read from the word investor is there. In the context of a gas pipeline where the state wants to invest millions of dollars in the gas pipeline, would they be considered an investor for purposes of this statute?
We haven't taken that to counsel. I think at this point in time, probably the confidentiality or whatever would probably derive from the Stranded Gas Act rather than these organic statutes of ours. But I'm not absolutely positive, but that would be my sense at this time. Mm-hmm. I would if you would like an update
Mr.
on what
Burns, go ahead.
Done on as far as the gas pipeline, we are in the process of an RFP to hire a financial advisor, a fiduciary. I say an advisor, it may be multiple advisors, to advise the board if we are asked to be a participant in the gas line. We think it's appropriate to be prepared. The RFP basically falls into three sections. One would be just the education of the board, just on how infrastructure investments, which is a developing asset class, is developing across the country, the types of things that we should look for if in an infrastructure investment, and also what specifically would be some of the hallmarks of a gas line infrastructure investment. So the first phase would be strictly educational. The second would be, and I don't know timeline-wise, if it would be the same time you would be taking up the contract or, whatever. I just don't know exactly the timing. But actually examining, from a financial viewpoint, what the investment in a line looks like. What are the attributes? What are the returns? Is it a good investment? And the third phase, if it's a good and prudent investment, how does it fit into our portfolio? How does it fit with diversification? All the other aspects that we look at when we go into any asset class, how does it fit with what we're doing? So it's education, the deal on its own, does it make sense, is it prudent? And third, how does it fit with the rest of our thing? So that's the RFP is on the street. I believe we're looking for returns by the 14th. 20th, I'm sorry. We had a pre-bid conference last Friday.
Representative Seat.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I presume one of the focuses of that will be whether it's a FERC-regulated pipeline or not, because we have a couple of different proposals. One would be FERC-regulated, another might not be FERC-regulated, and how that would those two different differentiations would impact the investment.
Through the chair, Representative, that's news to me. We haven't looked at it other than just it's going to be presented or a deal may be presented to us. So if as you said, if there's a FERC proposal and a non-FERC proposal, that would absolutely be part of the inquiry. But we have seen nothing other than there may be something presented to us, and we're trying to be prepared to respond.
Yeah, Representative Roper.
Well, apparently Representative Seaton's referring to another route, so because that would be news to me too if it was non-FERC regulated. So it was an all-Alaska route.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, at least the testimony we had from the all-Alaska line was that it was available for the $18 billion underwriting, but that they would not be FERC regulated. They're not necessity to be FERC regulated, but they might have FERC, but it wouldn't be a per se FERC regulation. So that could give us different answers on investments.
Right. Well, I paid very little attention to it, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I've just listening to the scuttlebutt that flies around the building, there are some people that would like to start another permanent fund with a gas pipeline so that we could perhaps have an actual money so that we could use it to pay for state services. And if that was the case, or if that's an option, then I would imagine that your investment to the pipeline, if you weren't going to actually have the all of the money coming in like you do with the oil, the 25%, would that make a difference in your investment?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that's pretty complicated, and let me tell you, I think the situation that the board is going to be in and the corporation is going to be in is going to be very similar to the situation you're going to be in. The way the legislation is structured, you're going to be presented a contract that is going to be yes or no. Our decision, if in fact we're asked, comes down to basically one thing. Is it prudent? Is it not prudent? Is it's up or down on prudent, non-prudent? And would it be prudent? There's so many variations in it,
right,
that this could go. I think it'd be a high degree of speculation to try to say what would be prudent or what structure would be or wouldn't be. We'd have to take in where the cash flows, who gets the returns, who is all that. But I would tell you, I don't think, you know, the Constitution today diverts 25% of the royalties to the fund. That's probably totally independent of the investment characteristics of investing money in a pipeline. I mean, I don't think I may be a little farther out on a limb. I'm not sure. I'd have to think that through. Again, there's a lot of variation, so I guess I don't have a black and white answer. But the simple answer is it prudent, and does it fit with what we're doing?
We interrupted your prepared remarks, but let's see if we have. Why don't we go through that, and then do you want to have a question or a follow-up on that?
Well, Mr. I just want to know how you want to structure this, because we have multiple
lots
different issues
stuff
here.
Right, why don't you
finish
your prepared remarks, Mr. Burns, and then we'll go through.
Well, what I just wanted to give you a bit of the history, why we're in those asset classes, what we like about them. And some of the I've seen, I guess someplace, I'm not sure exactly where I read it, somebody considered some of these investments out of the mainstream, and I would tell you quite the contrary. These, I think you could make an argument that the trustees would be imprudent for not have investigating these and making a very modest investment. Our asset allocation to absolute return today is 4%. Our asset allocation to private equity is 4%. One of our advisors is the treasurer of MIT. Their pension fund at MIT has 12.7% in private equity and 18.8% in other alternative investments. The Yale Endowment in 2004 had absolute return of 26.1%, private equity of 14.5%. Our own University of Alaska Foundation has a target for alternative investments of 25%. So, and the state pension fund has 3% to absolute return and 6% to private equity. So both ourselves and the pension board, I think, are very much on the low end of this. We also had some testimony, and I think it's interesting to just put into context. At our last board meeting, someone had made the testimony that they thought that if you had to give up 200 basis points to not be in these asset classes that aren't as transparent as some of the others, that would be worthwhile. And just like, you know, that's a pretty interesting little statement. 200 basis points on 8% of our fund is well over $50 million a year. That the Treasury, you say the state, the dividend formula, the state, whatever. That's a lot of money to leave on the table for, I think, a very well-managed investment in these asset classes. They're not perfect because they're not transparent, or they're not totally transparent. But it's a tough world out there that we're investing in, and we think we're doing it very prudently.
Mr. Chairman, can I just interrupt there a moment just to make sure that point is clear and I have it in my mind from Mr. Burns, is that take the total corpus of the fund, some $33 billion more or less, and your targeted rate is of that amount is 8% for your private equity and absolute return. And if you just take the 200 basis points portion of the 8%, yields the $50 million a year.
Exactly. Yeah, it's not the portfolio.
I mean, exactly. I mean, that's why it's so extraordinary here. That's a very small allocation.
Two percent of the whole fund is
$680 million.
Exactly. But no, I'm just taking on just on this small slide.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Someone, I guess, well, it was in your committee. We had a fiscal note on a resolution, and someone said the numbers look gigantic. We deal in very big numbers. I mean, it's tiny numbers multiplied by what is today, I think, very close to $34 billion. I didn't see the report before I came over this morning. But very small percentages, basis points, times $34 billion drives big numbers.
That's it?
My prepared.
Well, one of the issues that the committee wanted to overview today is I think there's a presumption that information should be made open and public. But as an investing entity, what situations are there that exist that would require you to keep information confidential from the public? And when, if ever, would that information become available to the public for its scrutiny?
Mr. Chair, at this point in time, the only areas that we have had any interest or any need to keep information confidential is in these two areas, absolute return and private equity, where we have this intellectual property. It is the strategies of the managers that is their stock and trade, and they tend to call that confidential. The only other area that we aren't as forthcoming on a timely basis is in the real estate area, while we're in negotiations, to make a deal. As soon as a deal is done, it is totally transparent. It's on our website.
Can you explain why real estate transactions are treated as confidential while you're in the process of negotiation?
Sure, Mr. It's a very, very competitive marketplace out there. We compete against others for the purchase of properties at various prices. We don't want to pay any more than we have to, but we want to pay enough, and we identify what it is appropriate. We have advisors that will tell us that this is the range, this is the cap rate, this is the return, and we think we're certain that's absolutely vital to our decision-making process, and it's a bidding process.
Is the amount that the fund is willing to invest in those kind of transactions, which are initially kept confidential, also kept confidential from the public?
Mr. Chair, if I understand that your question correctly,
let me okay. Give the background. In other words, one of the concerns the public may have is the fund putting an inordinate amount of money at risk on secret deals? And when would the public ever have an opportunity to weigh in on that, except maybe after the fact when things are disclosed? You see where I'm coming from. In other words, it's my understanding that the overall fund is managed by the prudent investor rule. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Okay. And you want a reasonable amount with a reasonable return. Isn't that also one of the guiding principles?
Absolutely.
Of the fund? Okay. Explain a little bit more then the confidentiality, the cone of silence that comes over the transaction, and when the public knows what's going on.
Mr. Chair, the public, you can go to our website today and see what we have allocated. The trustees at least annually do an asset allocation, and we have today 10% of the fund allocated to real estate, and that falls into two categories. Privately owned real estate, which would be, I refer to them as an address, a building, a complex, whatever. We also have a fairly large investment in real estate investment trusts, which are publicly traded securities, but strictly in real estate. So those two assets, or those two types of assets, make up our real estate allocation. So that allocation is absolutely available to the public at all times. Underneath that allocation, when we are negotiating a deal or trying to negotiate a deal or trying to make a purchase or, for that matter, trying to sell a property, that's when we're very quiet until the deal is done.
Right. Are there any other transactions? I'm sorry, is there questions on that point? Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, in terms of the absolute and private equity and even hedge fund type investments, which I think are absolute, is that correct? The hedge funds are absolute,
yeah.
Right. Does the corporation publicly name the institution that you've contracted with, for example, Carlyle Company or KKR or some particular named group that is public information, like there's the Carlyle Group 1, 2, or 3, or Gotham Investors 4, 5, and 6 groups, or what? Are you able to name those?
Well, through the chair, Representative Roekberg, we have a what we call a gatekeeper, and let's just stay in the they're pretty similar, but the structure, we'll just stay in the private equity side. Pathway is our gatekeeper. They will go to a KKR or Carlyle or all of those. And those partnerships, they'll make a commitment to those partnerships. The commitments that they have to those partnerships on behalf of us is what's important to them, because their competitors then know how much, how many resources they have available if they're going to bid against them. You know, it's can they outbid them because they don't have the resources? So that's the kind of thing. So at various points in time, how much we have committed to a Carlisle or to KKR is available. Other times it is not. It's where they are in the deal.
Right.
It sounds pretty vague. But.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just as a point, though, because one of the concerns is there's lack of transparency, lack of knowledge about what the investment medium is. I guess my suggestion is if after, for example, during the initial real estate deal-making process, there's an absolute necessity of confidentiality until it's closed and it's done. And presumably what you just described in terms of the brokering, if you will, of money, so for a certain period of time, there would be a quiet period also. But then after that period, then it would be disclosed publicly that you had an investment in XYZ partnership two or something. Is that correct?
This is Laura Ashe through the chair, Representative Roekberg. We do publish on a quarterly basis the names of the underlying partnerships in the private equity portfolio, and we publish the total commitment to them. What we don't publish is the amount that they've drawn down so far. Now, it is on the absolute return side, we don't publish the names of the partnerships that are absolute return gatekeeper Crestline, and we've just hired two new ones invest in, because those relationships that they have with those absolute return managers are considered their proprietary information.
And for follow-up, Mr. Chairman, therefore, I think you can make the argument that given the process, there is disclosure of where the funds are and who has responsibility for them, but not the nitty-gritty. It's not like as if you're buying a mutual fund which has a periodic list of what stocks perhaps are in an equity portfolio, except to me they're always 6 months behind. So there's kind of intentionally not knowing where they're at the particular snapshot at a point in time. But the let's see here.
We'll come back to you, Representative.
Yeah, I just missed my motion there.
Yeah, a couple things. First of all, the REIT aspects, those investments, what you're putting into real estate investment trust, those are not confidential, are they?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, those are publicly traded securities. They're, no.
Yeah,
The only thing where they're public, we liquidated recently a lot of REITs, or a fair number of REITs, almost $300 million, I think, when it was done. We're fairly quiet about going about that, especially in an asset class like a REIT, because it's a fairly thin. They operate like a small cap stock. There's not a lot of liquidity, and it's not helpful for us to be selling $300 million worth of REITs into a thin market if everybody knows we're selling $300 million. You can be your own worst enemy. So, our trading strategy, no one's ever asked us about it, but we buy and sell things every day. But especially in some of these asset classes, small cap, REITs, emerging markets, how you get in and how you get out is a big part of your strategy. So, but it's public, but we don't telegraph it.
Yeah, another question, then Representative Roekberg, and then I had a question about Crestline.
And then I had a follow-up. Would you, we're talking about private equity as a term of art here, I think. Can you define for us in the public the private equity asset allocation and what's entailed in private equity?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, we view private equity as having more or less the same risk characteristics as public equity. So we put them about equal. The two things that we really like about the private equity class is, one, you are paid for the illiquidity. If you have the ability to tie your money up for a long period of time, and maybe even not a long period of time, an undetermined period of time, you're rewarded for that, or that's part of the value proposition. Liquidity is not a problem for the permanent fund in any way, shape, or form. So we'd like to take advantage of our ability to use our liquidity. And the other thing is that it gives us access to probably, pick a number, 50,000 private businesses that may or may not be part of this private capital market that you don't have through the public market. So it's a whole group of other companies that are not public, and it's you're paid for your ability to take the liquidity risk.
Okay. So just an explanation, that would be a non-public company that has either, whether it's a partnership or a stock or private stock, or I'm just trying to figure out what exactly private equity means for, you know, the public and the investor.
Recent one of the largest transactions, and it's much larger than most of them, Ford Motor Company sold Hertz. They own the Hertz rental car company. They sold that to a consortium of private equity managers. So Hertz is owned by several of the KKRs, the Carlyles, whatever. What the ultimate disposition, what their strategy is, will they ultimately take it public? In private equity, there's always something they call the liquidity event, which is akin to the payoff. Do they take the stock public? Do they resell it? Whatever. But they define a value, whether they buy a division of an operating company, whether they buy out a family-owned company that has estate planning problems, or they see value. They see value in a public company that maybe is not maximizing its assets, in their view.
So, but just to get back to a more fundamental point here, okay, so we're talking about private companies and they're issuing bonds. Is that what we're, I mean, I'm just trying to find out the base. We've got this term of private equity, and I don't think we've ever come out and said to the public, here's exactly the kind of thing we're investing in, and they're not.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, if let's just say we were in the Hertz deal, we would be invested through Carlyle III, which is a private equity thing. We and others investing in Carlyle's private equity general partnership would put in the equity. Whether that partnership would then go out and borrow some money to leverage the transaction, or it's an all-equity deal, would be driven by what the financial aspects are of Hertz rental car. How much debt can it service? How much can it, you know, what's the appropriate capital structure?
Did you hop in here?
Yeah.
Follow up, Ms. Ashe, and then Representative Roberts.
This is Laura Ashe through the chair, Representative Seaton. Mike, the advantage I bring to the table today is that I'm not a finance expert.
Actually, the advantage you bring is that we get your profile on camera and his voice.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate that. So Mike's going to correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I'm going to try and answer your question the way you're asking it. You have public companies that trade on the markets, that trade in the public stock and bond markets, and then you have private companies. And Paul Seaton, LLC, Fishing Ventures, might not want to go public and sell shares, but you might still need funding. And so this would be a situation where, like, a Carlyle may, and of course we're talking about, you know, multi-million dollar companies, but this would be a situation where they would see a multi-million dollar company that's a private company and would make, am I on mm-hmm. the right track, and would make a direct investment into that company. And so Carlyle gives the company money to expand, to go to that next step, to do whatever it is. That would be like a venture situation. There's other funding situations. And so that would be what private equity is. It's investing in private companies that haven't gone public. And then, as Mike said, then sometimes they become successful enough. They go to that next step. Google took in a lot of, I don't know how much. Google did have private equity investors. And then they went public, and now anybody can own a share in Google. But this is just a different way to invest in corporations and get a return without going through the public stock markets, but just going through the private. Does that answer your question?
Sure.
I might just add just one other one that would be familiar to people here. A number of years ago, CSX Rail Systems owned Sealand, they decided they want to get out of that business. Sealand was sold to a private equity partnership. Okay. I don't know what happened since then. What, I don't know if they've gone public or they sold it, but that's how it was just a division of business, a line of business that CSX no longer thought met their hurdle rate for investment. And the private equity people thought they could make it work.
Representative Roakberg.
Right, and good examples in the state of Alaska. Foothill Energies now is a North Pole refinery. Maybe over Yukon Pacific as a subsidiary. Probably, I'm not sure if it was a subsidiary or another separate entity. I mean, there's a plethora of private capital availabilities in terms of equities in which to invest. But a couple of things. Mr. Burns, through the chair, one of the concerns that I have, and you mentioned earlier that when you were seeking management firms, that it's a seller's market. And one of the issues is the level of confidentiality in our regulations and dealing with your ability to recruit the very best. I think I had somebody as your predecessor, Mr. Storer, used to put it in terms of whether you and the Permanent Fund had the ability to hire the A team or the first team off the bench or the B team or the C team. Because there's a level of sensitivity apart from these firms. Many of the very best companies wouldn't even undertake us if we had, for example, greater disclosure of their business activities. They wouldn't even consider taking Alaska up as a client. Could you expand on that?
Through the chair, Representative Roakberg, as I mentioned earlier, that probably 75% of the returns are in the top third, the top of the class, if you will, and it's obvious that's where we want to be. I had something probably 2 weeks ago today, or maybe 3 weeks ago today, that in the 18 months I've been in this position has never happened to me, and nor did I ever imagine that it would happen. But I had an absolute return manager who we had narrowed the search down to three more that we were going to add, called us 2 days before the board meeting and asked not to be considered, specifically because of the disclosure, you know, that we do have in it. So, and if you think about the economics of money management, I mean, bringing in a new client like us requires virtually no additional cost. I mean, once your overhead is covered, new revenue drops to the bottom line, and to walk away from a very substantial fee from us because they were afraid that we would disclose their stock and trade, the intellectual property, I just didn't think would happen, you know. And it sounds a little bit like you cry wolf that, you know, people won't want to do business with us if we you know, don't work to keep their stock and trade. It happened. And I was very surprised. And I don't think we're out in the forefront of, you know, of that issue, but with more than they wanted to take.
Mr.
Chairman, if I might take a different tack now. I've been on somewhat the receiving end as a sponsor of HB 215, which was passed by the legislature last year and has been used as somewhat of a whipping boy to say that the corporation has greater authority to proceed more confidential and or more confidential nature. Well, number one, I reject that particular thesis. Also, I would like just to restate that I was very pleased to hear your description this morning about the yields and returns to the state of Alaska on the former fixed income portion, which in this rising interest rate environment, I felt very compelled to help remove the cap by enacting 215. And if we've, by my calculation and your statistics, increased the yield over 5.5 basis points on whatever portion we've been able to shift out of the fixed income portfolio, I am very pleased. I mean, we accomplished the number one goal in that legislation. But secondly, in which we in the legislature reviewed, were these additional investment vehicles that you wish to take up, and I think rightfully so. And but that said, I'd like you to describe to the committee the historic context of the issues of confidentiality. The Permanent Fund Corporation, from its very inception, always had a regulatory framework in which that would keep particular issues confidential. because of the nature of the business environment, as you've described well this morning. There has to be a certain amount of stealth, confidential activity in the strategies of the marketplace. There's no question about that. So we have always had confidential regulations on confidentiality regulations on the books. But because of the absolute return in hedge funds and the private equity situation, it just exacerbated it, and you updated the regulations. But in terms of a basic public policy, we really haven't changed the field much at all. Or have we? Could you explain that?
Through the chair, Representative Roekberg, I think the answer is no. We have not. Let me go back to your premise about what 215 right. had to do with this. And I've said many times, and you know, 215 is a huge step forward for the fund and for its asset allocation and its investment ability. House Bill 215 has absolutely nothing to do with this issue. I mean, again, the confidentiality statute was passed in 1980 when the fund was created. We have added nothing to the regulation. The regulation is a combination of the statute that's been on the books since 1980 and some language from the Open Meetings Act. There is no new power that has been derived from House Bill 215 in any way, shape, or form that has anything to do with this. As I said at the very beginning, nothing is confidential today that wasn't confidential a year ago, that wasn't confidential 5 years ago, that wasn't confidential 25 years ago. Nothing has changed in that way. And
I think that's one of the concerns, too, that is maybe implicit. When the legislature changed the basket clause, increasing it, the investment opportunities, and the resolution that came out the same year that we amended that bill that was sponsored by Representative Roekberg, there was no connection. Is that right? Or
no, that's absolutely correct.
There was no connection. And I just wanted to highlight something that Mr. Burns said that I want to make really clear. When I was the project manager on working on the resolution and working on the regulations, and in working with our council, it was made very clear to me that the board cannot take on any sort of authority that isn't given to us in statute. The statute tells board to keep certain information confidential. All that the regulations that were newly passed in November can do is to clarify that. So there's no new authority that can be granted in regulation that the legislature doesn't give us in statute, and it wasn't.
Let's see. Representative Wilson and Representative Roekberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Burns, if nothing has changed, regulations, everything is the same as it always has, and then why all at once are these questions start coming up? What do you think? Are people asking questions that they never asked before? What is causing this?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I think you have, and I'm speculating a little bit, I just think you have a basic issue of journalism. I think anything, you know, Chairman Weirach's business in the legal profession, if you have evidence that is obtained through an illegal search, they call it the fruit of the poisonous tree. My sense is that from a journalistic point of view, if there is a tree out there that's confidential, no matter how tantalizing the apples are, the journalists don't want us to partake. I'm not a journalist. My instincts go to let's get the best return for the least risk, but I'm not a journalist.
But there's always a tension between the public's right to know and the ability of an entity like a corporation to have a reasonable return on the public's money. Isn't that correct?
That absolutely no.
And that at some point nothing is forever secret.
That is correct.
Okay, Representative Roekberg, follow up.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I know we're on receipt of the letter from the Alaska Budget Report. Ms. Braun, she's in the audience. Is she going to be testifying?
No, I wanted to ask Mr. Burns about the redacted portion of this because there was a Crestline, attachment to the letter which you have, And I'm not sure that redacting that information falls under the intellectual property exception to the public disclosure statutes, or what the basis for redacting that information. Was that done with the corporation's permission, or did it divulge public information that would harm the state's investments if it were not redacted? What are the policies there?
Mr. Chair, let me give a general view, and I would like Laura, because she's actually in charge of this information flow. But it is very much a process between our lawyers and Crestline or Pathway or whomever. It's very much a give and take. And I would say the process is they need to prove to us or convince us that this is a vital strategy of theirs. I mean, our natural instinct is to disclose, and so we push it back to them as to why they have to convince us why this is part of their intellectual property. Very much a give and take thing. We've been able to come at some type of a balance with Crestline and with Pathway. We're in contractual negotiations with two new managers today, with Mariner and Lazard, for absolute return. But this is an issue. You know, we've agreed, the board's agreed to hire them, but are we going to contractually be able to come to the balance that they like? I mentioned the other firm. I don't think I'd like to mention their name, but they said they just didn't want to be considered under those guidelines. So
let me ask Ms. Ashe, but if you make a determination that something's confidential and is not released, once you make that determination, what's the remedy? Court?
Yes.
Okay. Ms. Ashe?
Representative Weirach, I'm not clear. Your question was you wanted to go through point by point and see.
No. I wondered what the general concern related to the public's right to know that forms the substantive reason for redacting the information in the Crestline information submitted to the committee.
Well, the reason that the information on these pages was redacted was because Crestline believed that these pieces of information would give away their proprietary strategies or the particulars of their business affairs. They presented their arguments to our counsel, who worked through the regulations and worked through the statutes to determine if he felt that the information they wanted redacted was legitimately confidential under the statute. And then he made his final determinations, which then Mr. Burns is the designated head of the agency with the authority given to him by the board. Then
when you submit a request for proposal for an investment manager or anything like that, do you indicate that under state law your information will be subject to public disclosure unless you advise us in writing what should not be?
We don't go through the regular RFP process for our financial managers because they're fiduciaries. Mr. Burns might be able to explain it a little more accurately than I do. We have not until now started to run into this issue, and to kind of go back to Representative Wilson's question, I mean, a lot of this is coming up now because now for the first time we're getting into the sorts of asset classes that generate a lot of this kind of information, where before it's really only pretty much been real estate. So
is that a direct result of House Bill 215's passing?
No, sir. That would be a result of House Bill. Oh, well, I'm not sure.
1999.
It's the creation of the basket clause in 1999, the 5% basket clause. That's what allowed the board to move into these investments in 2004. And so I think there was a second part of the question that I've lost my train of thought.
No, I just wondered if you advise the people that submit information to you that the information is public unless otherwise advised in writing, why it would not be subject to public release.
In the past, we haven't. I think as we proceed forward, we probably are going to be more aware that, I mean, like, for instance, this Crestline, I can't recall whether this document came from 2004 or whether it came more recently, but in 2004, we had three absolute manager candidates come before the board. All three of them provided presentations. All three of them marked every single page confidential. Those three presentations were requested, and we went through all three of those presentations, and let me tell you how fun it is to call somebody that you told 2 years ago you weren't going to hire them and go through a presentation of theirs that they mark confidential and say, our statutes say we can keep certain parts of this confidential, that we have to keep it confidential, but we're not going to be able to keep it all confidential. So that is a situation where it wasn't a regular RFP process, but whether that information that they provided as part of that bidding process a lot of it was made public. And going forward, I think that we are going to be front of people and let them know that a lot of the information they want to keep confidential, we're going to have to release.
Okay, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Laura, do you think that that's probably why you had one person pull out?
That was absolutely why. It was one of the two managers that had bid in 2004, and it was going through that process was what raised for them the concerns. And I have to say, I don't agree with all of their concerns. I think, you know, one of their concerns was that we post our minutes on the web. 2 years later, someone was able to go back and read everything that they'd said, and they didn't like that. And I think that that's very much a legitimate thing for us to do.
If I might add, just to your question, it's not like we think that's why they pulled. They were very straightforward about, I mean, they said exactly why they pulled out. It was because of this. It wasn't we inferred that or tried to read between the lines. They were very straightforward about it.
Further questions by the committee? Anything? Anything, Representative Roper?
Mr. Chairman, just putting it in context, as a public corporation, we certainly have responsibilities to our shareholders, which are people of the state of Alaska. So we certainly are different than a private company. But in looking at other states, other jurisdictions, for example, you've cited several public universities, or actually private universities, they're private. Where do we stack up in terms of other, say, pension funds and other, in terms of this type of an issue? I mean, do you have any idea there that, you know, when you did research for the newer regulations? Do you have comments on that?
Through the chair, Representative Roper, we didn't research the policies of other states before we drafted our regulations. Council drafted our regulations off the regulations that are in place for the ARM board, and based on his interpretation of what the authority was granted under statute. I haven't done enough research to be able to tell you statistically where we fall. I can tell you anecdotally, I've spoken with some other states, and I've spoken with some other with some private equity managers, and we fall somewhere in the middle range, whether it's at the high end or the low end, I don't know. I know that there's states that have to give out a lot more information than we do. I know that there's other states that do have statutes on the books that allow them to hold confidential information confidential. And again, I'd like to point out that our statute doesn't say we can, it says we will hold confidential information confidential. And I just want to quickly, you talked about the private universities that are in these asset classes. There's public universities in these asset classes too, and two in particular are the University of California and I believe the University of Michigan.
And the University of Alaska.
Well, I was going to actually make the point that those two public universities were actually shut out of private equity firms that they had relationships with in the past after they were required to disclose information that those firms felt was confidential, and these are states that don't have statutes that are similar to Alaska's, and so they were required to release a lot more of the information than we're allowed to release under law, and so it is another specific example of being shut out of a partnership.
Mm-hmm. Representative Roper, then Representative Wilson. Actually, Representative Wilson, then Representative Roper.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, fellow.
Thank you. Last year, the university did have a bill in that they wanted to be allowed to keep more of that private. Is that what you're talking about right now?
I'm not familiar with that legislation.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just would, I'm looking at the letter from the state budget report, or Alaska budget report, and there's a implied in the letter said that the stated that hedge funds were notorious for or famous for failed derivative transactions, citing the long-term capital management debacle of 1998. And then by implication, a letter from the famous letter of the shareholders of Berkshire Hathaway from Warren Buffett, admitting that he made an error when he lost some $104 million in his shareholder capital by investing in derivatives. But I found that very interesting. Perhaps the budget report, we prefer that we get out of the absolute return in private equity business and then put the money in buying Berkshire Hathaway stock. But then we'd had to have put up with the problems that Mr. Buffett's had with AIG and Hank Greenberg for the last year or so. It's like jumping from the frying pan into the fire there, if you get my drift.
I guess one of the lessons that I leave here today is that the legislature and the people of the state of Alaska have put a tremendous amount of trust in the trustees of the permanent fund and in your management, and that the purpose of having confidentiality restrictions and is to shine a light on practices and policies and transactions, that if a light were shined on them, they may be shown to be suspect or imprudent types of investments. And I know that you're not running around doing that. But to the extent that the fund loses a tremendous amount of money and a transaction was kept secret, there will be howls that the legislature will respond to because it will be politically popular to do so. We don't want to do that. And I know that the legislature last year enacted provisions to remove trustees for cause. And we wouldn't want to go down that path either. So I think that the committee, as well as probably the people, want to make sure that they get a return on the investment that's reasonable and that's prudent, and that we do not put too many eggs in one basket, and that to the extent that there are confidentiality restrictions placed on information that's done in a limited fashion to the benefit of the people of the state of Alaska, and that there's a tension to the benefit of the people of the state of Alaska, because on the one hand, people have a right to know what their government is doing, and you're part of the government. On the other hand, we have a right to return on investment at some point, even if there are confidentiality restrictions imposed, which may be prudent to do, as you've testified, that they're limited and that eventually they come off, and so people can see what happened. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the letter that we have here. One of the things that's a little disconcerting is that there's 13 denials of public records, and then the ones that, you know, quoting from here, the documents that we do receive are, you know, so heavily redacted. I'm curious about the 13 denials instead of having those redacted. I mean, is that the case that there's an outright denial of information, or is it that the information was so specific that it would be 100% redacted?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, everybody's allowed to apply their own adjectives. And the letters in question, two of them I know were letters asking for the 10-day extension. That is allowed under state law. The other, I don't remember exactly how many letters we've sent out, but I know that there were letters that were sent out that said that redacted information was being provided, and I believe those letters are being characterized as denials. So in very few cases were entire documents withheld. For the most part, we provided every single document with redactions, and then they're being characterized as denials.
Okay, appreciate that. And just following up on this one, which is involving Crestline investors, I just wanted to note that, you know, on the back page, although the individual investments are out, the full totals of costs and additions, withdrawals, and all of those are shown on the document, so that it's not as if this is a black hole in which we don't know what's happening with the money. It's just that the individual investment partners or investments aren't shown. So just for the public, because I don't think they've seen these documents, I just want to make that clear.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, just what Crestline manages for us is 14 strategies and 46 managers. So how they move money from strategy to strategy is very important to them. What they see as an opportunity, what they see as not an opportunity. I mean, they're trying to find inefficiencies in the marketplace. And so That's why these strategies are so important to them. And when they move from this type of strategy to this type, I could go through the strategies, and they're by name. It's a little bit mind-numbing, but we spend a lot of time with it. But I think there's 46 partnerships that invest in 14 different strategies. And again, they're all in the absolute return area. They're not looking for big returns. They're looking to cap. They're managing the risk.
Representative Roseberg.
Mr. Chairman, I take it you want to, am I ready to adjourn here?
I'm going to let everybody ask questions and as long as we want. So, Representative Roseberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On another topic, you did talk about earlier is the gas line issues. You and I, Mr. Burns, have had some discussions about this in the past. I, for one, remain quite skeptical, albeit I do agree that we have an opportunity under the prudent man rule, just so that's followed. Number one, could you tell us where you're at in terms of the request of the governor to look into this, and or the or your board, or and then secondly, your thoughts on this in general?
Representative Roper, just to interject, did you mean we have an obligation under the prudent investor rule to look at the investment or to make the investment?
No, to how it would be constrained. I believe that the corporation is constrained by the prudent man rule in making any investment. In other words, there would be even a cap or a total allocation to a singular project is something that I think is a limiting factor under the prudent man rule interpretation, or any investment strategies that limits concentration and aggregation in a portfolio of one particular type, one entity or company. So,
through the chair, Representative Roseberg, clearly, you know, concentration is a big part of the prudent investment decision, and that clearly is going to be taken as one of the things that an individual or an outside fiduciary would have to opine on for us. We have no specific requests from the governor or anyone else. Commissioner Corbis is one of our trustees, indicated that our name in various financing schemes that they've had and they've looked at the name has come up repeatedly as a source of capital, as an investor in various forms. So where we are is in this RFP process to hire an independent fiduciary to help us through this, if in fact we are given a proposal. Right now we don't have any more of a proposal than anyone else, but we do want to be prepared if asked the question to have the resources to go through it thoughtfully and prudently.
Just follow up, Mr. Chairman. What's the genesis of the RFP? Is it internally generated by your own board, or at the request of the governor, or who requested the RFP?
Well, the board, actually staff suggested the RFP process to the board. The Department of Revenue has made it known to us as a group that we are part of their thought process, but there's no specific request. It just seems prudent to go through this to, when asked, be in position to answer intelligently and prudently.
Well, just further follow up. Yeah, it seems to me that that any fixed income instruments that might result from the pipeline, which I imagine there will be significant numbers, would be rated by the rating agencies, and you'd follow standard fixed income principles in making investments in bonds. The major issue, I think, then would be the absolute return type or private equity placement. I'd say private equity placement here. If the permanent fund were to buy a portion of the pipeline or participate in the equity of the pipeline itself, and then there's the issue of the pipe as a entity and shipping responsibility. So there's two sections of ownership in terms of the pipeline. But so it just seems to me that there'd be significant constraints on what the permanent fund could do, number one, in terms of its gross investment in the project, and then two, I think I'm somewhat troubled by the fact that I don't know how that would fit in the purchase or equity position of the state of Alaska. If, say, for example, you could pick up 4% of your position, well, however that would relate to the state's position, then any benefits would derive to the corpus of the permit plan, not the state of Alaska. So I'm not sure I understand how that, what value that would have, other than just a straight investment in the part of the permit fund to the state's position.
Through the chair, Representative Roekberg, I think what you, just that last statement you made, I think is the most, is probably how we have to approach this. I mean, I think there are great benefits to the state in delivering its gas, you know, to market, monetizing the gas, creating employment, all of the things. But that's clearly on your side of the table. Our side of the table is an investment in that. Does it stand on its own? Does it have the investment merits that we need? Does it clear our hurdles? Is it prudent? And that's why we're hiring a fiduciary. And I don't have a copy of the RFP with me here today, but there's no section in that about the independent fiduciary opining on whether this is our investment in this is for the good of the order. It's got to be for the good of the fund, period. That's as far as we can go under current statutes, and that's where we are. So I mean, it has to stand on its own. It has to fit in with the rest of the fund, as you noted, and so that's where we are. But we don't have. I mean, I don't have a specific proposal in front of me that says it's our role is going to be this, or we're requested to look at this or that. We don't know what we're going to be asked, if at all.
Well, you and I have a conversation in the past where you were uncertain about whether you thought the legislature would be needed to authorize any participation, or does it depend on what type of participation it would be, whether you needed additional legislative authority to proceed?
Through the chair, Representative Roper, I mean, we're in front of the Finance Committee right now requesting a special appropriation to hire this fiduciary. I don't know how this will unfold eventually, but my sense is that if, in fact, the legislature approves the contract, which I think is the process that you will be going through, I'm sure there's going to be a whole package of legislation that will surround that. So how that would affect us, I can't speculate because I don't know what I'm still going to be asked to do.
I think that it's interesting to note, Representative Roekberg, just in maybe commenting on that, the fund had testified last year that it did not need any special legislative authority to invest in the pipeline if it otherwise met all the other requirements for fund investment, prudent investor rule, reasonable return on a reasonable amount, and all those constraints.
Mm. Yeah, I don't disagree with that, Mr. Chairman, within the constraints of the definition.
Did you have a follow-up then, Representative Seaton and Representative Wilson?
Not bad.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And just for a little clarity on here, there's three. As we've been told, there's three kinds of ownership in a gas line. One is in gas, another is in pipe and the pipeline, and the other is in shipping volume. In your RFP, are you looking at just the pipe, the investment in pipe, or are you looking at somehow ownership in gas or in shipping volume?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, we are asking people to think about how they would advise us on the pipe, on the transportation business, not gas ownership.
Okay, not gas ownership. So,
or marketing.
Through the chair.
Yes.
So then we're still left with two components of ownership. One is ownership of shipping volume, which is bids and contracts and all that kind of things for actual volume through the pipe, and the other is the actual pipeline itself. And I just want to get some clarity because I would imagine the shipping volume would be a managerial and, you know, quite a different business than investing in, especially if it's a FERC pipeline where there's a set return on investment and all. So between those two, is the RFP looking strictly at the pipeline itself and not looking at ownership of shipping volume?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, Yes. Now, that's within the context that we haven't been asked specifically anything. But my sense is that it is going to be, just as you said, the latter, that it is the pipeline itself. Not we don't have any expertise in marketing gas or would, you know. Now whether the ultimate marketing of the gas is probably an integral part of whether the pipeline itself makes sense, or what are the risks of the investment based on what the marketing challenges are, it will come into that. But my sense is that our role would revolve around the line.
Okay.
But again, I haven't been asked.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. I just wanted to say that I think it's really good to get that clarified, because you know, we are talking about three different kinds of ownerships out here, and two of those, shipping volume and gas itself, I would see as very problematic within the structure of the permanent fund. And so the pipeline has a fairly defined set of characteristics that can be analyzed, and I just wanted to make sure that that's what the RFP was going to be considering.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Burns, I guess I just want to kind of pull my feelings together of why this meeting was called. I have to say that when I saw the Alaska budget report letter, you know, it was kind of like a red flag, and I did have questions. However, hearing what you have said and how you've explained things to us, I really think that you probably have been very prudent in what you're doing and why you're doing it, and exercising very good judgment, I feel. And I feel pretty comfortable about what you're doing and how I can respond to my constituents. So thank you for that.
We appreciate that very much.
Any further questions from the committee? Mr. Burns, please here. I think that there is some, when you talk about investing in a large state project, the last state project that asked for investment by the permanent fund, a really large project, was the Susitna Dam, which resulted going away because we couldn't get a full faith and credit of the permanent fund to support it. So who knows whether that's lingering there. The other thing is, in just doing research and preparation for this meeting, I did look at case law from California, and CalPERS, their public employee retirement system, does allow confidentiality restrictions to be imposed on their this kind of same information. So maybe as there's precedential applications to the Alaska Permanent Fund, I don't know. The facts may be different, but at least for that corporation, there is. And then in law, the opportunity to invoke confidentiality. And then finally, you've handed out some information. I just want to make sure that the Attorney General's office does not come by and try to sweep up anything you've handed out.
I think we're square.
All right. Any further questions or comments?
Thank you very much for your time this morning.
All right. Thank you. We're adjourned.